in brightest day, in blackest night, all other podcasts tremble in fright. Losers cower before the power. Orange is lust and blues you can trust. Indigos feel and white ones heal. Yellow scare and green ones dare. That sapphire love and black hands glove will rock your foundation without hesitation. Chad and Marge face evil's might. Respect their power, for they'll make you see the light.
Hi, everybody. I'm Chad Bokelman.
I'm Mark Marble.
And this is the Lantern Cast.
Episode 555. And God help us, I hope we're not doing this when episode 666 is due.
Oh.
I really hope our time has come and gone by then.
I just had an idea for what we could cover. What was the event where everybody made a deal with Neron?
Oh, you mean Underworld Unleashed?
Yeah, we could do Underworld Unleashed.
Yeah, that is true. They're technically speaking, there would be plenty of opportunities, plenty of different storylines or even Famous Firsts or something we could actually do to tie into the number. But I'm just saying, God, we've been doing this a long time.
Yeah. All right. Well, what are we talking about tonight?
We are talking about Godzilla X Kong, Godzilla Times Kong, Godzilla Plus Kong. It's called, how about name, giving it a normal name and people don't have to play games. I don't know. So spoiler alert that this is a full spoiler discussion. I haven't been waiting for 2 weeks to talk about this movie to pussyfoot around.
And I finally saw a movie after it was released while it was still in theaters. How about that?
Yeah, still later than you said you were going to, but you did see it. You were relatively close. Didn't throw off recording.
Yeah, my own personal end date was I see it on Sunday or I bail on the recording. So I saw it on Sunday.
I appreciate that.
All right. Well, where do you want to start, man? Box office or reaction or first thoughts? What do you want to do?
Let's do first thoughts. I mean, I do want to do some box office stuff, but that usually is more of a wrap up, I think, or as we're segueing into past, basic plot point and general thought discussion. So, yeah.
All right. Well, you've been waiting for a long time. Go ahead. You start us off.
I enjoyed it for what it was. I think the first, 40 something minutes is a little slower than it needed to be. I think since you don't really see Scar King or Shimu probably until at least about the 45 minute mark, at least. I mean, once you get to that point, everything moves crisply, but by default, you almost have to. But I thought that I didn't think, a lot of criticism on this movie has been, as I bang my headset, a lot of criticism has been about how stupid this movie is and the plot. And I don't necessarily think the plot really is any stupider than most of the other movies in this franchise. But I think there are some cool things in this. I think it's a good, character arc movie for Kong, which of course we'll talk about this too. Some Godzilla fans, that's enough alone to tip them over the edge. Though I think sometimes, a ripped candy wrapper is enough to tip Godzilla fans over the edge. But, and I did like the relationship, well, not just the relationship between Gia and Kong, but I like the symmetry and the symbolism that they raised in this movie, that both were kind of like two fish out of water, that they both don't feel like they belong anywhere. They both think they're the last of their kind and they're searching for their place in the world and for belonging. But which is hard because they do think they're the last of their respective people, which of course turns out to be not true for either one of them. So I think I did kind of like that. I thought so. I was more along for the ride with that than I think some people would be. And I think they cut Godzilla into this movie better than they did the last one. I know some people have said that, and we'll talk about screen time because I'm curious what you think about different things, but I do think that regardless of whether he is or he isn't in this movie more than the last movie, I think they cut Godzilla's story into this a little more consistently. So it feels like, to me anyway, he felt like he was on screen longer than he was in Godzilla versus Kong.
Maybe you say cut Godzilla's story into it better. Godzilla, I'm trying to not let my fandom of Godzilla over the other kaiju rule my thoughts here, but I think it would be fair to say that Godzilla didn't really have a story in this film. He was essentially a force of nature reacting and keeping everything in check. That's a kind of about it. Like when he went, oh God, I knew. Is it Tiamat?
Yes. Okay. Not to be confused with the celestial coming out of the ground of the same name.
Yeah. When he went to take on Tiamat, it was odd to me that he would attack Tiamat unprovoked simply for a power up, since he's supposed to be, you know, maintaining the balance and really only goes after kaiju, other kaiju, when they step out of line, I guess. So that was a little odd to me. And obviously he needed to get his ass kicked back into place by Mama Mothra separating the two fighting boys. But I don't honestly think there was a storyline for Godzilla in this movie. He was just a force of nature on a collision course, and that was kind of it for him. When people say this movie is stupid, I can see what they're saying, but I think that's a harsher criticism than it deserves, and or a harsher label than it deserves, because there was definitely more comedy and camp in this film than any of the priors. And I don't think it was out of line, because it was present in prior films, specifically Godzilla versus Kong. And it just seems like it's a slow ramp up to what we have now. But also, as a Godzilla fan, period, I have to reflect on it and just be like, look, if I expected them to maintain a serious tone for the entirety of the franchise, then I'm doing a disservice to the history of what came before with all the other Godzilla movies. Because, yeah, there were serious Godzilla movies. And then there were Godzilla movies where Godzilla did a flying jump kick by riding on his tail towards his enemy, or flying through the sky by tucking his tail under him and using his atomic breath to launch himself through the sky. There was camp and stupidity in all Godzilla movies. So it has its place just as much as any sort of other seriousness. So I can't knock it too hard, other than realizing it tonally had more camp and comedy than any other movie in its franchise from this production team previously. The story arc and development for Kong and the girl and everything, that was cool. I will say, though, the movie did feel pretty rushed. I know you said it was sort of slow for you at the beginning. I kind of see that, too, but it also felt like it was over a little too quickly. And some of the stuff that bothered me, you know, obviously we'll get into some more specifics later as we go, but like just one thing off rip to Shimo being just like a slave animal with barely any intellect of its own beyond the kind of quick look back and forth as they fight when it's finally freed from the crystal. That was kind of weird. I was kind of, I don't know why, maybe this is just my own idiosyncrasies, but I was expecting more, I don't know, agency on the part of Shimu, in terms of maybe having chosen to work with the Scar King, or I don't know. I just, something about Shimu seemed wrong to me throughout the film, but I don't think it was a bad film by any stretch of the imagination. There was a lot of stuff that just happened out of convenience, and that's partly why I say some of this is pretty just stupid, in terms of what the other fandom has said in terms of the stupidity of the film. You know, at least I kind of get the sense that the first couple of films, whether we're talking the original Godzilla in 2014, Skull Island, or even to some extent King of the Monsters, was at least trying to stay within the confines of trying to explain things in a scientific way, I guess. I mean, as much as you can talk about a hidden race of ancient Titans in a scientific way. But also, you know, another thing that happened in the films of the Tohoverse and stuff like that is, you know, we're dealing with aliens and otherworldly species and stuff like that. So, like, having a secret subterranean culture of humans that are capable of telepathy and these advanced understandings, despite being a primitive looking species, it doesn't, you know, it that's not any more out of place than aliens can, you know, creating a space clone of Godzilla, you know? So, like, when you're working in this verse, you kind of have to take the good with the bad and expect it all just as equally, I guess. I don't know.
No, I think that's true. Looking at some of the things you said, now, one can make the case this wasn't necessarily true in the 2014 or King of the Monsters, but I think it absolutely was true in the last movie that the way you describe Godzilla is accurate, but that's no different than the way Godzilla behaved in the last movie either. That's all he was doing. It was like,
yeah, I guess it just seemed more on the nose for some reason in this film. Maybe because there's so many other kaiju involved. I don't know.
Yeah, because Godzilla and we talked about this when we saw the first trailer when they were portraying Godzilla out to be the bad guy, thinking a different of how that could work plot wise. And of Godzilla either being controlled or, of course, if they had gone the classic Mecha Godzilla route where he appears to be Godzilla at first and nobody realizes that he's not. But the problem with Godzilla is he's easy to control, even if he doesn't realize he's easy to control, because all you have to he's like Pavlov's Godzilla. All you have to do is wind him up and pointing him and send a signal somewhere where you want. Make him think there's a threat because he can't think. That's one of the problems. He has no this Godzilla seemingly has no deductive reasoning skills, no. He can't really he doesn't have the capacity to process information very well. He's pretty much all instinct. So all you have to do is if you send a signal somewhere, he's going to follow it and he's going to do what he needs to do. So when he was destroying all those apex places and the bases and the research facilities in the last movie, he was picking up on the Ghidorah thing, but he didn't entirely know what they were doing. But even if Apex had just wanted him, if Apex had wanted him to destroy like cities on purpose, not anything to do with their research facilities, all they had to do was plant something related to the project, you know, under San Francisco, under here, and Godzilla was just leveled everything because there's no ability to process. Just like even in this movie, like when he attacks Kong, he should know Kong's not the threat that he's amping up for, because number one, he already fought Kong once and he was wrong the last time, and Kong saved his life. And why would you need to ramp up and evolve to face Kong if he was the threat? There's like a disconnect that Godzilla has, and it may not have been consistent in 2014 as prevalent in 2014 in King of the Monsters as much. But I don't think Godzilla behaves in this movie any differently than he really does in Godzilla versus Kong. It's just now it's up for grabs, really, whether the main reason he was evolving, and we'll probably find this out down the road, how much he was really evolving to take on Shimu and how much he was evolving to face a bigger threat that's coming in the next movie. Because I think it's really up in the air if he was completely evolving, just because it's not like he did particularly. He didn't dominate Shimu, which, of course, some Godzilla fans still insisted. Oh, well, he was dominating Shimu when they fought. It's like, yeah, come on. But we'll get to those points later. But not that I care much about the Shimu debate, but it's like Shimu was doing fine against Godzilla. There was no winner in that fight whatsoever. And he was not she was not particularly hurt. So, but and related to and you related to like some of the humor. Yeah, I agree, even though a lot of the humor had to do with Kong, though, and a lot of the humor was kind of organic, like when he used Zuko as a sack of potatoes to beat the other gorillas. That was so funny.
Yeah, there was that. So the only way it paid off is because it came full circle. But when Scar King was like going down, you know, like when they were introducing themselves to each other, the tooth, and he like pointed and laughed, and I was like, this is stupid. And then... But you get the payoff a little bit later when he knocks Scar King's tooth out Kong smirks at him. So like, okay, whatever. But the cheap, stupid laugh. But like a lot of the comedy too, like with what's his name, the veterinarian guy.
Yeah, yeah.
They also literally did the 80s flight crew walkout slow-mo thing once or twice, which was weird to me. There was a big prevalence of 80s type stuff going on here in terms of music, soundtrack stuff. And then the comedy between, you know, and I'm always terrible at remembering character names, but between the veterinarian and the podcaster guy, at points I was just like, okay, can we get to the story? Like there are moments, especially when like he would turn his handheld camera around to himself and we'd use that POV for a minute. It's like, can we just go? So there were moments where I was just like, okay, enough is enough.
Yeah, I mean, like we know, it's a fine line with these movies. It's like everybody historically has always complained that there's too much too many human storylines in these movies. But that goes back to all the Godzilla movies too, which people conveniently forget. Almost all the Godzilla movies, there's very little Godzilla in it per capita, and it's the human storyline driving the majority of the movie. And part of that, no offense, is because Godzilla, while he's cool, he's not the most interesting character to be spending time with overall because of the fact that, at least in this version, maybe arguably in the older version, you know, the Showa version, especially when Godzilla was a good guy, that maybe there was more personality there. This Godzilla, like, it is a force of nature. He is like a one trick pony. So you can't, and they hinted that they might want to do this in the next movie, and I don't know how it'll work, but I don't think with this Godzilla, you can tell the stories with Godzilla like you can tell with Kong, because Godzilla doesn't have that kind of range. You know, somebody said, and I think it's, I don't necessarily know if I agree with it 100%, but I think it's mostly accurate, that one of the things they do really well in this movie is that whenever you see Kong's face throughout this entire movie, you almost always know exactly what he's thinking or exactly what he's feeling. And you don't get that out of Godzilla, because Godzilla is mostly a blank slate. But you can tell different kinds of stories with Kong, which isn't to say that if they did the next movie, to be fair, that they shouldn't maybe lean it more Godzilla heavy. And if Kong's in it, be a supporting role, kind of similar to how the last two movies have gone in favor of Kong. I think that would be fair. But like even some of the humor, like the you talked about the Scar King thing. Much funnier is when that other gorilla after Kong intervened and that one gorilla that was being treated like crap on the ground, and that other gorilla got in his face and just kept yelling, and Kong didn't say anything or roar anything, and then just Guy Gardnered him one punch and just knocked him out.
I also like the moment where he first encounters other apes and he fights one and he falls over the cliff and saves him, and then when he saves, fights him again, he's like, oh, okay, and then just kicks him off the cliff.
But the thing they do a good job with related to that is they did it very well in the beginning. Like you could, when they had that frog like thing, there was the way it was, the sound it was making kind of sounded ape like. So Kong went out looking, thinking that maybe it was another of his kind, that because he is lonely and because that's a pretty big burden to be carrying. I mean, the last one. And Kong has been carrying it for a long time, since Kong's been, as far as he knew, the last of his kind since he was friggin' like an adolescent, that he shows a lot more patience with him. And obviously it pays off with Zuko. But, you know, Zuko is a real dick to him for at least the first third of their relationship. He's horrible, the way he sets him up to get killed in the lake by that monster and all that stuff. And that was funny. See, that was funny, too, the way he kills the monster in the lake, and he just throws the axe on purpose just so Zuko will have a trip over it. it's just kind of funny. It's funny because, in a way, you really hadn't seen that in Kong yet in these movies. Even the last movie, which was understandable based on this, he was like literally a fish out of water in those movies, even more so with being on the carrier and then being in Hollow Earth and all this stuff. That you kind of see, you got a little bit more of Kong's personality in this movie, and a little bit more of, if you will, like how Wingard described him in the last movie, that he is kind of like Clint Eastwood in Unforgiven. It's like he's old, he's bitter to a large extent, he's done that, doesn't want to be bothered, but, you know, if something comes to him, he's not going to walk away from it, and he deals with it. But
yeah, I also see this is a term that gets overused at this point, and I actually literally was just thinking the other day that I wanted to buy the DVD box set of Happy Days, but
the shark.
Yeah, jumping the shark on this film, it kind of felt like it a little bit, you know, and now that I think about it, this film reminds me of the turn that happened, albeit a little quicker for this franchise, for Transformers. The first Transformers movie, like, yeah, it was pretty cookie cutter and everything, but it was pretty damn good. I do love rewatching that first Transformers movie. Shia LaBeouf and Megan Fox, notwithstanding, it doesn't matter. Like, it was kind of cool. It was really set up, but then we just get more and more robots, more Cybertron, more zaniness just happening to, you know, this thing fell to Earth and it's a secret, and, you know, just like it kept getting more and more crazy and more robots and more CGI. And I really felt that with this, because some of the moments of comedy felt a little forced and a little too long, like with Transformers. Some of the monsters and the CGI rendering was just a little bit much or a little bit wonky, like with Transformers. And it just kept reminding me of just kind of we went too far with Transformers to a point where they had to kind of reboot it, I guess. And I'm worried that they're in danger. I'm not saying that, like, you know, this is as bad as, I don't know, what was it? The Last Night? Was that the one?
Yeah.
The last one in the Michael Bay franchise. Yeah. But I see the potential for us to go there based on watching this movie. And it bothers me because I'll specifically point to the initial chase scene with Kong and that pack of dog like kaiju, when he pulls the one and it, you know, it rips over his head and the guts spill on, and that CGI looked whack to me. That looked really, like, when you see CGI and they say everything looks wet, like, yeah, he's wet because he's like spilling guts all over him, but it just looked really bad to me. And I thought that was a one and done type thing. And I was like, okay, maybe this is just a kind of a brief moment and it's kind of complicated in sci-fi to CGI exactly how you would think it would look. So maybe that, whatever. But then it happened again when Godzilla was fighting the big spider creature. There were several moments throughout the film where the CGI was not up to par. I can only say that as a viewer, because I recognize those moments that I felt taken out of the film. I'm not a technician by any means, so I don't know what all goes into the CGI, but I know when something doesn't feel right visually. And there were a couple of moments there for this film, and that bothered me a little bit, because if your main franchise is going to be a bunch of titans fighting each other with very fanciful designs, and some we recognize like Godzilla or Kong or whatever, then, you know, if you're going to rely, you're so clearly going to rely so heavily on CGI, then the CGI has to stay up to par every new film we get. We can't just keep scraping by with, okay, we'll really focus in on the big story beats and the big moments, but only moments where we're going to quickly see them or hear there or whatever, or it's the humor of the moment is more important, then we'll let it slide just a little bit here and there. No, you're focusing on fictional, you're not putting anything on camera. It's all digital, so it has to be up to par. And it felt like there were a couple of moments where it wasn't up to par.
To me, I didn't really notice that as much, or if I did, it didn't take me out of anything. Now, if there's an explanation for that, part of it could be because this is technically, ironically, this is a MonsterVerse movie that had the smallest budget. It had $135 million budget, so it cost the least amount of money to make of all the movies we've gotten so far.
Including 2014?
Yeah. Yep.
Wow.
Yep. So, yeah, this had the smallest budget, which means it potentially has a chance, depending how it keeps racking up money. It's going to be profitable. The question is, on the sliding scale, how profitable it is. And we'll get to that. Two things. Transformers. Yeah. I mean, to me, I never liked any of the Transformers movies really, but I agree. The first movie was less shark jumping than anything that came after. Something I wanted to talk about, but I lost my train of thought and I went in a different direction. The Shimu stuff. I think Shimu, when you think about it, Shimu was kind of like somewhere a combination of the Winter Soldier and kind of like how they showed Kyle when he was Parallax. That it kind of was along for the ride on some level, like the Winter Soldier was, except being consciously aware of everything he was doing. he wasn't being mind controlled in the sense he wasn't being. It's a fine line because it's the same thing. You're being forced against your will, and you kind of know you're being forced against your will. So that's why it reminded me of the Parallax Kyle thing, where he was like sitting in a room, basically almost like seeing, looking out through the window, seeing what your body's doing, and you can't control it. Shimu wasn't that much, but it's somewhere in between, because obviously Shimu was being controlled by pain, and that's the reason why she did what she wanted, not because by choice. But I thought it was important at this show, even in the beginning, when Scar King realizes, well, I'm kind of like the Heath Ledger thing from The Dark Knight. It's like he's not willing to risk you know, the battle for the soul of Gotham on a fist fight with Batman. Neither is Scar King willing to risk his entire kingdom on a fist fight with Kong, which he could lose, or may very well lose. So when he was getting when they brought Shimu out for the first time to go after Kong, you could see that Shimu really did not have any great desire to do this. So I thought it was important, based on the turn they were going to give us at the end and just the overall ending of where Shimu's place and everything is, to make it clear that she was not an active participant at all, and being freed was important to her. And I thought that worked well, I thought, with her, especially because she obviously was a Titan that was very difficult to deal with if you had to deal with her, as you saw in the movie. So I thought that was okay, the way they handled her.
Yeah. Quickly, one of the notes I wrote down was, I thought it was funny too. So Godzilla, you know, cause we've heard, you know, if you're a Godzilla fan at all, and you've heard anything about how people, you know, try and figure out and make his mannerisms, you've heard Godzilla is basically a big cat for a lot of people in terms of his mannerisms and how he acts. So him curling up in the Colosseum, okay. I was actually okay with that. That said, I also thought it was really funny. It was one of the moments of humor I laughed at when he's leaving the Colosseum and he's walking down the channels or whatever, and the helicopters are following him, and one of them gets a little too close and he kind of nips at it. I thought that was funny as shit. I was like, Godzilla is so recognizes the humans in his presence that he's just like, okay, you're following me, but can you get off my ass for a second? Jesus, too close. You're bothering me. Step off.
The Colosseum thing was even better because of the way they bookended it at the end. This is like his adopted napping place.
That's true. I will say, part of the stuff that I wish they would have spent more time explaining stuff on would be, you said is Gia, right? That's her name?
Yes. Yeah.
Gia's people in the Hollow Earth and how they split, and the she's so connected to Mothra that it's strange to me that her people were on Skull Island and had such a close relationship with Kong, and Mothra was never mentioned until now. I always thought Mothra would be a more natural thing, but here's the deal. They're sort of tying in those two, because those were two different in the Tohoverse. So I was speaking, but not actually like connecting the dots for the people. In the Tohoverse, yes, on Kong's where Kong was, there was a tribe of people, and typically when you saw him, they had a sort of relationship with Kong and the island and everything like that. And yes, Mothra typically had like the twins and stuff like that. So there were like an ancient peoples, you know, who had connections to Mothra. But the two, as far as we knew, unless I'm forgetting something, Mark, and I know you watched some of those old films too, so correct me if I'm wrong, the two tribes were never connected. So unless they were making a connection between the two, but still, you didn't take enough time to deal with all of that. And yeah, we kind of got the info dump from when they went into that little chamber. But first of all, I understand she wrote a book on the language and you know, is raising Gia and everything. But her being able to just look, regardless of how educated you are in the moment, unless you have been spending time writing in this language and speaking it and so on and so forth, like, there's no way you're just going to read it that quick, right? Like, even if you're an educated person, but that's neither here nor there. That was like a small tidbit I had. But the connection with Mothra and her people, that threw me a little bit, because it seemed to come out of left field for the legendary verse. Anybody looking at a tribe of ancient peoples and you know, especially when you start talking about telepathy and stuff like that, and and more of a empathic feelings as well. That all screams the native peoples that had connections with Mothra from the Toho verse. But for this, it was just like Gia and her people are so Kong, 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 Kong that when they suddenly went, no, Mothra, I was like, wait, what? Although I will say for a brief second there, I was seeing it coming because for a second, I thought that the person, the leader of the people in the Hollow Earth coming out would be like a twin of Gia. Like, obviously not her sister or anything, but like a twin of Gia. And then we would get kind of the twin aspects that we used to get with Mothra. But all of that stuff kind of threw me for a loop briefly, if I'm being honest. I don't think we spent enough time explaining all that.
No, they didn't. But I think in a way that's a byproduct of we didn't get, unfortunately, we never really got. They kind of blew the opportunity. I think that was one of the things that they, that, I think that was one of the storylines they took out of King of the Monsters. Remember? Because maybe there was something that was taken. I'm trying to remember which movie they did a big change in. I think it was Godzilla versus Kong, actually. I don't think it was that one. So maybe there was going to be more of a tie-in to laying the groundwork for the interpersonal connection concept with Mothra and building on whatever little tidbits were, if any, and there were some, I think, that were dropped in King of the Monsters. So maybe they felt like they had to make up for lost time. And I mean, it makes sense because obviously Gia's people are obviously have a pretty strong symbiotic relationship with Titans anyway. So I guess depending on when they branched off, and that's the one thing you can make a case that was a little disappointing, even more than the Mothra connection, is that they really don't play up any real Kong connection between the Hollow Earth tribe.
Yeah.
But again, we don't know how long ago they separated, and because that's a whole, like, there's like a whole, at least a book. We'll probably never see a movie, but there's like a whole book or a series of books that could fill in this gap because we don't entirely. Now we can assume now it's related to Scar King and things like that, why some of the apes just left and or were forced out and ended up on Skull Island. And maybe that's why some of the people were too. Some of the people that, because maybe there were two separate tribes of the same people living in different places on Hollow Earth, and these people were able to protect themselves and the other people were not, and they basically went with the part of Kong's family that ended up, you know, the ancestors that moved and went to Skull Island through the portal, and that's where their relationship with Kong, you know, that literally formed the beginning of their symbiotic relationship. But yeah, I mean, I'm glad they didn't kill Mothra. That's kind of a surprise. Not that she dies in every single movie she's in, but she does have a pretty good track record of dying.
Well, that's just because they built in all the larva staying behind and the tribe looking after the larva. And
right.
The new
You always had a backup.
Yeah, the new set of twins that would help the new Mothra emerge, you know, all that stuff.
So. And I think they didn't mention in the movie, but I think they did say somewhere in the backstory for related to Mothra in the Monsterverse that essentially it is the same Mothra, as in obviously not the physical body, but the memories and everything get passed on from one Mothra to another. So that
either housed in the collective consciousness of
probably
this tribe or
I don't necessarily think it has to do with the tribe. It's kind of like that genetic memory concept.
Okay.
And whenever there's a new Mothra, that basically it does remember everything that came before and everything Mothra had done and participated in new before.
So when you were speaking, that reminded me of the point I wanted to touch on. And now this gives us even more reason to circle back to it, because if it's the same Mothra, I wonder if the same thing is this. It can be said for all primary Titans. So to both your genetic memory point and then the point I wanted to raise, tying them together, I think Mothra having genetic memory passed down, that's okay. Like whether she's dissipating into energy or laying some larva or whatever, that's one thing. And then we have Kong, who very clearly we see the bones of his parents, and we see his progression of age throughout the films that we've seen so far. But Scar King, when we get down to the Hollow Earth and we start, you know, this tribe has a history of things. Scar King was on the surface you know, eons ago and wanted to rule over the planet because he was, there's something about like he wanted to block out the sun or something like that. What are the, what were they saying? I kind of blanked on the specifics of his goal.
I actually don't remember that line.
But so he gets, because I remember he gets to the surface and sees the sun and is like, I made it, you know, kind of. But unless Scar King, you know, of this legend had kids and then, you know, passed down the story however he would have to your children as a large ape like that, and then Shimu also had children, but they were raised in captivity or something. Like, I don't, like, these have to be the same Scar King and the same Shimu. But what does that say for the ability of apes to age? And then also, like, what about Godzilla? Because we clearly see in the first Godzilla versus Kong movie, when Kong gets down to the Hollow Earth, there's a indentation of what looks like the spine of a Godzilla type creature wrapped around the throne. And then we're also, you know, thinking of the possibility, it's never confirmed or denied or whatever, of Scar King's little whip thing being the spine of a Godzilla type creature. So, but we did see Godzilla smaller in prior iterations when we were like, especially they made a point to do it in the Monarch TV show, but obviously he hadn't yet been exposed to a nuclear bomb. So obviously that affects his physiology. So is this the same Godzilla or is this, you know, just another in the line? So like it raises the question of the age of the Titans, because especially when you see how old Kong is getting, and then you also think like, okay, well, is there a factor in the Hollow Earth that keeps them from aging? I was just very confused about the lineage of these Titans.
The Hollow Earth thing could be valid because of the radiation, because of the type of radiation that it is. Just like it could make you stronger, it could extend your life. It's possible. I'm kind of thinking Mothra for the most part. If this, again, this is something that I heard after the fact. It's not like it was ever confirmed in the movie, because it could turn out to be total BS, or it could be something that after the fact, upon further review, the Wingard decides if, because obviously the way this movie is going, if he wants to do a third movie, that's pretty much all but guaranteed that he will get the opportunity to, that maybe he'll just go in a different direction or never flesh it out in his own mind. Maybe he still thinks it, but it never actually comes to fruition where it ever has any payoff, because it's because arguably it might be difficult to. I mean, Mothra doesn't really commit. Unless you're going to have somebody translating from Mothra, you really don't know what Mothra is thinking or really saying anyway. I know in the other Godzilla movies, there is a track record of having some pseudo subtitles, so you know what the monsters are saying to each other. So that wouldn't be foreign if they ever decide to do that. But without getting in her head, you don't really know. I'm kind of thinking the genetic memory thing, if it is true, is more just unique to Mothra. It doesn't mean that some things can't get passed down from ancestor to moving forward. I don't necessarily think that it's impossible, but as far as if it really is true that Mothra like remembers that this Mothra remembers everything that happened with Ghidorah and King of the Monsters, and I think that's unique. And I'm pretty sure the way they establish it in this movie, like Scar King is Scar King, that prophecy and everything in the paintings and everything, that was about him, and that Shimu's been around for a long time too. And it would make sense because these Titans, because we know a lot of these Titans that we hadn't seen forever had been under the earth or under the water, had been buried and dormant for who knows how long. So it's not impossible for hundreds of years or whatever for some of these creatures to have just been dormant. And that could be true even with Scar King too. There could have been time where they were dormant in Hollow Earth, whether it's related to Shimu or not. There could have been a time where they were not completely active or as active too. So that's another possibility. They become active and they become, depending on what's going on, if Scar King's goal is to take over the surface and things aren't looking too promising, then maybe they just kind of like, maybe they go dormant again, or Shimu, he forces Shimu to kind of do that. And I don't know. So.
Yeah. And then what I mentioned earlier about Godzilla actively killing Tiamat, that bothered me a little bit, just because I guess it can make sense. Like, if you're like, look, no matter what, the threat is so bad, I have to power up, and you're not going to let me do this. I have no choice but to take you out. I guess that's okay, but it just, it doesn't track as naturally with everything else we've seen from Godzilla thus far. Like, it's, there's a very, I mean, yeah, like, you don't see Godzilla thinking too much, obviously, as you mentioned earlier. It's just, that said, there has been a very you're upsetting the balance type thing going on with Godzilla, and him killing Tiamat purposefully without any provocation seems strange to me.
I think there is some, again, some unwritten in the, well, not necessarily unwritten, but unshown in the Monsterverse, that there was something that I did see somewhere, which I can't tell you where. So again, it doesn't, that the idea that Tiamat and Godzilla are kind of rivals and they both ideally would be looking to take each other out, that was kind of like already established. So if that's the case, if that is the case, and there is some backstory between the two to begin with. So Godzilla could see him kind of as a threat long term anyway. And again, kind of like the Galactus thing, except without really conscious thought as much as just instinct, that if Godzilla feels, if he is driven to the idea that something is coming and he needs this power because basically he's the only one who's going to be able to deal with it and Tiamat couldn't deal with it no matter what, that he may say, well, it's kind of like, well, you know, kind of like that. Well, you don't really deserve this power, so I'm going to take it for myself. Or you can't, you don't really know how to, kind of like Hal and Emerald Twilight. That is like, you really don't, when they're trying to use, I think it was when Jack T. Jance made the gun. It's like, really? And it's like, you clearly don't know what you're doing. So like, let me relieve you of the responsibility. That kind of thing. So I think, and there is one of the things that, and we'll talk, we'll start moving into some of this soon, that the, some of the weird things Godzilla fans zero in on and trying to, and
that, oh, we can do that now. I'm done with any sort of plot stuff.
That part of the fan base, that one of the things they played up, they like playing up the bully aspect, which I find incredibly interesting, because if you accept, which kind of go, and this is why it's almost a nice segue based on when you were going. If you accept the concept that Godzilla is somewhat of a bully because he does kind of pick fights that he doesn't necessarily need to pick just because he can. And, or if somebody happens to be around the neighborhood, it's like, they're not really a threat to him, but, or they can't, he really can't think they're a serious threat. If you accept that theory, then the people who are kind of like expounding upon this and wrapping themselves and around it, supporting it, then they're cheering for the bully. And I'm not saying there's not necessarily any truth in it, but the reason why it comes to mind is I saw two, there were a lot of stupid things that a fraction of the Godzilla fan base, and I kind of jokingly have said, and I think I said it to Chad, it's almost like we know where all the Snyderverse people went. It's like they went to be a certain percentage of the Godzilla fan base. And I know there's a certain percentage of every fan base, which is like, I don't know, questionable. But Godzilla fans seem, a certain percentage seem really, 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 like a fingers in the ear, eyes closed. I'm not listening. Even if stuff is blatantly put in front of them, it's like, nope, don't want to see it. Which is 2024. I mean, come on, this is 2024 society. Why would anybody want to accept anything that doesn't fit their narrative? But I saw two things related to the bullying. First, it was the idea that, oh, it was good to see Kong is still getting, Godzilla still bullying Kong, or Kong is being bullied by Godzilla, which I think is questionable anyway, since there may be an element of truth that he's picking on Kong unnecessarily, but Kong always fights back. So it meets some definition of bullying, but not your 100% classic, which is that usually people don't fight back if they're getting bullied. They could be, not always the case. They could be fighting back, but they're being picked on unnecessarily. It meets that definition, but again, you're rooting for the bully if you think that's a ha ha ha. And an even crappier one, which was, and this was before we knew Shimu was coming, but a lot of people didn't, and we hadn't seen pictures of her yet, because I believe she is a she, that the idea that teaming up against Scar King, and somebody actually wrote this moronic analogy trying to say, it's like the bully and the kid that he's bullied teaming up to take out the school shooter. That is so fucked up on so many levels.
Yeah.
I mean, forget about the applying it in 2024. I mean, that's just really a real horrible, horrible choice of words. But again, the whole point is you're like championing the bully if you think that's the case. Another thing that really drove me up the wall, because it's not the same person, but I saw it in multiple threads. And this kind of reinforces, I guess, the 2024 version of my favorite quote, or one of my favorite quotes, that if a million people say a stupid thing, it's still a stupid thing. That I guess the 2024 version is kind of like, if a million people, you know, put thumbs up and like a stupid thing online, it's still a stupid thing. That people said in multiple threads, they picked out the Skarsgård quote from the last movie about how the world needs Kong. And then they contrasted with, mind you, in the movie, the quote's not actually the same. But in the trailer, we get the quote, Kong can't stop this on his own. In the movie, it's actually, they mentioned it, it's Godzilla, because they're tying it into Godzilla and Mothra being together. It's not really a Godzilla-Kong quote in the movie. But in the trailer, they're supposed to make you think it's a Godzilla-Kong quote. But either way, they try to make it seem like those two things are contradictory. And they're not contradictory at all. I don't know. People's thought process is really disturbing, how people can jump from point A to point D, and it makes no sense whatsoever. It's the same thing when you break it down to what Tony said to Steve in Civil War when he said, "The world needs you, Cap." It was never supposed to imply that Steve Rogers, on his own, by himself, could stand up to any threat to Earth. It was supposed to imply that he was an important piece of the puzzle, and that he was important in protecting Earth, and that the world was a better place with him in it. And that's all the Kong quote really meant, even moving beyond the Skarsgård's selfishness of wanting Kong to help him explore Hollow Earth. But looking at it in the big picture, that's why the world really needed Kong. It was never to imply that Kong by himself could stand up to anything by himself, just by himself. So, but there were lots of things like that. I don't get it. It seems like Godzilla fans, when it comes to Kong, are really, really, it's weird. Somebody said, oh, they're insecure, and I never took it that way. I just honestly took it as arrogant, but maybe there is an element of that. I don't know. It's weird. Like the Egypt fight. Here's a spoiler alert. Kong really won the Egypt fight, because only one of the two Titans was ever knocked out, and it wasn't Kong. Kong just stopped fighting because he never wanted to fight to begin with. His goal was to get Godzilla to Hollow Earth, and when Godzilla wouldn't come willingly, he knocked him out. And you know he knocked him out because there was a cut before you see him dragging Godzilla by the tail. It doesn't immediately go to that. Like the punch, you see him grab Godzilla, you drag him. There's literally a dust-clearing cut, and you see him already in the process of dragging Godzilla. Doesn't matter what happens after that, because if Kong had wanted to kill him, he had the opportunity to. But he didn't. So people conveniently ignoring that and saying, oh, yeah, you know, Mothra hadn't shown up, but you never would have gotten to that point.
Yeah. It's a Batman thing. Everybody.
Yeah, it is.
Batman wins in all scenarios for Batman fans. And there are Godzilla fans who are like, Godzilla is king of the monsters. He's going to win every time. And there are times when I feel like that, but he's usually like I compare it to like a pep rally in high school, you know, like the school spirit type of thing. I feel that way when I'm all getting all hyped about Godzilla, but realistically speaking, you know, there's going to be some fights that he's not going to win. And that's kind of the point of some of the Toho movies. He gets
just
handed to him in a couple of fights, and then he rallies and figures out a way to beat whatever the other Titan is later on in the film.
Yeah. And even in some movies, and of course, in some movies, he actually loses because he's not the good guy.
Yeah.
But I think I told you when I watched Godzilla versus Gigan, which was Gigan and Mechagodzilla against your favorite but completely useless Anguirus, and Godzilla
always completely useless.
Always useless. I like him too, but he's useless. I feel bad how useless he is because he gets bloodied and his ass kicked all the time.
Yeah.
They don't really win that fight. You know why the fight ends? Because Gigan and Mechagodzilla start fighting amongst themselves and they leave. But for the most part, they're beating the shit out of them.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's and I think I might have mentioned to you that. And I like Dan Merle's stuff online, his podcast. I think he does a fantastic job. And he ranked all the Godzilla Kong movies. And I don't know if he's a big Godzilla guy or not, but based on his rating scale of how he scored some fights, it's like, I don't know. It's like he gave him a draw versus Mechagodzilla in the last movie. He got his ass handed to him that wasn't even a fight, other than pushing Mechagodzilla back once. He got his ass handed to him. So if you're going to score that as an individual one-on-one fight, if you're going to score it that way, he absolutely loses. If you want to say, if you want to say, well, you know, at the end it became a two-on-one fight and the good guys won, okay. But if you're talking one-on-one, he lost, just like in this. Best case scenario, objectively, and this isn't me rooting for Kong, this is objectively. Best case scenario, Egypt is 1-1. Kong wins the first round and stops. Then Godzilla, because he stopped, gets a chance and he wins the second round. But if you're only scoring it once, you never would have gotten to the part where Godzilla was had a chance to kill Kong, because Kong had him out and he just wouldn't have stopped hitting him. So that's, I mean, it's just weird. But oh, the glove. We didn't talk about the glove at all. The thing that I did like about the glove was the fact, I liked the fact that they tied it into why the glove conceptually existed, because it was something that they learned, or a lesson they learned from the last movie with Mechagodzilla. That there was an idea, seeing what Mechagodzilla was.
That sorry, you said there was an idea, and I immediately translated that to Avengers.
Yeah, and that's Monarch, not necessarily wrong, too. Because
Monarch had an idea.
Yeah.
To bring together the most powerful titans.
Hey, we have at least four and four and a half, if you count Zuko now. We have some Avengers ready to roll. But yes. But the idea was, because of what happened in Hong Kong, that there could be some threats specifically that Kong might not be able to handle on his own. And the idea of giving him an upgrade mechanically, technologically, was important. And of course, you know, the government and everybody else didn't really go for it. And that's the reason why there was only that one test prototype ever made. But that was the idea. Now, you could read into it also saying, kind of was an equalizer against Godzilla, which it turned out to be quite a good equalizer in case Kong ever needed really to fight Godzilla when Godzilla was a bad guy, because you know there is the realistic possibility that when Godzilla's goals don't match the humanity's goals, then Godzilla's going to do what he wants anyway. And the fact that Godzilla is unfortunately this version of Godzilla, because he has no critical thinking skills. It's really easy to wind him up and pointing him in a direction that he really shouldn't be going in, but he won't be able to figure out or stop and think, maybe this isn't the threat that I'm dealing with. So there may come a time when Godzilla thinks he's doing the right thing, but he's not doing the right thing, and somebody has to stop him. So that could be conceptually another reason why the Beast Glove was created, even though they didn't necessarily say that in this movie. You could very easily read into it that was one of the reasons, the concepts behind, because Kong, just generally speaking, at least you can be, not that he's just the smarter, it's the fact that you literally have a way to communicate with him. With Godzilla, I mean, good luck. Mothra might be able to communicate with him, but, you know, Kong gave it the college try, man, pointing to the hole and everything, hands up, wait, yo, bro, listen to me. And all they got was, the suplex was cool. I thought that, it was unfortunate Kong was on the receiving end, but it was funny. It was funny. But I also thought it was a nice payback when Kong threw the sand in his eye, too. And then he just pounded the shit out of him. Now, that was a little bit of... That was, in a way, Wingard, I think, paying you back for the last movie. But then I think he kind of ruined it at the end, because he didn't have to have Godzilla with his foot on Kong again. They could have just been squaring off with him about to get toasted, and that's when Mothra came. But that's me as the Kong guy, but... It's like Wingard still got a Wingard. He's a Godzilla fanboy at the end of the day. So I maybe he can't help himself. I don't even know if it was he's doing it to appease the fan base. I think he may just do it because he can't help it. But anything else?
I think
else
all we got left is box office.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure. Oh, before we get to now, in your opinion, do you think Godzilla had more screen time in this movie or the last movie?
The last movie.
You theoretically, I mean, technically you are correct. I just, this is just not, you can't confirm this because it's not like WB or Legendary put this out. But yeah, he had about close to two and a half more minutes of screen time in the last movie. But I think they used it better in this movie, to me. Like I said, I think because they cut his story in, it doesn't feel like he's out of the movie as long for big, as many big chunks as he was in the last movie. But, yeah. But yes, this was the least amount of screen time Godzilla had in any of the four movies, which is ironic because if this is accurate, these numbers, let me zoom in because I can't see this thing. This is ridiculously small. That technically, according to this, Godzilla versus Kong had more screen time for Godzilla than any other movie. But a little bit, not much, but a little bit over King of the Monsters. So let's, yeah, as far as the box office goes, this movie, as we speak, worldwide has made $362.8 million, which puts it a little bit less than 20, no, 20, that's not wrong. Yeah, a little bit less than $20 million behind Godzilla King of the Monsters. So it will catch that. That's a given. After that, it depends how well it does overseas. It didn't really hold all that well. It made me nervous how it was holding last week, actually, because it was kind of giving off the Quantumania vibe based on how the box office was dropping from day to day to day, because usually Tuesday box office is bigger than Mondays, but for Godzilla and Kong, it wasn't. It was bigger on Monday, less on Tuesday, less on Wednesday, less on Thursday. So it looked like you could have been heading towards a like 70% drop, which you didn't have. But I think the real key to this movie, because the movie after that to catch would be the worldwide would be the 2014 Godzilla at 529. That I don't think is, I don't, no, let me take that back. I skipped one. Godzilla versus Kong made 450 worldwide. So after it passes King of the Monsters, which it will, the next movie, it's at 362.8, it has to get to 450. So basically like another 90 million or so, which it may do, but a lot of that's going to depend on overseas. It's done really well in China, and it all depends how much money more it makes overseas. So it's no guarantee it'll catch Godzilla versus Kong, but it has a decent shot at that, but that's probably where it's going to stop. Now, domestically, it is already the third highest grossing movie. It's already way ahead of King of the Monsters and Godzilla versus Kong, with, of course, the asterisk if that movie had opened up not so early in the pandemic recovery without the day and date, you know that movie would have made a crap ton more money, not just domestically, but certainly domestically. Specifically, that movie would have made a lot more money if it had not opened when it did and how it did. Now, I think you might know this. Now you do know what the... Now, of course, if you were paying attention, it's the only movie I haven't mentioned yet, but you do know what the biggest grossing movie in the franchise is worldwide.
Skull Island.
You know, yes. That is the only one that I didn't mention, but that is...
It also has the acting caliber.
Oh, I'm not saying it. I'm not saying that as a Kong badge of honor, saying, hey, even though it is good as counter to the crazy part of the fan base going, hey, you know, the biggest grossing movie had no Godzilla in it at all. But no, I'm not saying that just to say, hey, look, it's Kong's world and we're just living in it. It's just the fact that it is an interesting byproduct that movie is the biggest grossing movie worldwide, because you would kind of think that a Kong movie wouldn't do as well overseas, because you kind of, maybe it's just the U.S. bias here, thinking that he's our guy, so that he wouldn't be as popular overseas, just like you would think Godzilla would automatically be more popular overseas and Kong wouldn't be. So it is an interesting little twist of fate. But yes, looking at the production budget, Skull Island actually had the biggest budget too, for what it's worth. Skull Island had 185, and yes, probably a lot of that went to the cast. When you factor that in, that probably had more big name cast members than any of the other movies, you know, that would be demanding salary. So Skull Island 185, King of the Monsters 170 budget, Godzilla 2014 160, Godzilla versus Kong 155, and Godzilla X Kong 135. So it is interesting, probably because of how poorly King of the Monsters did. They probably made a concerted effort going forward to try to roll the budgets back, because that movie did not do well. So it's kind of like an insurance policy to help guarantee that the movie is all but guaranteed to make a profit. So, but it's just an interesting tidbit with the budget. I liked it. I think it met my expectations. I still don't know what they were thinking giving Rebecca Hall that haircut, though. I mean, that was such a horrible look for her. I'm sorry. But I liked it. It'd be curious to see where they go next. And I'm glad it's doing well. Glad I got my bucket in my drinking cup on that Thursday night, since they sold out real quick at my Regal. Mm-hmm. I think that's all I have to say about the movie. How about you?
I definitely gave it its fair lumps in criticism. I will fully admit it's my least favorite movie of the franchise so far.
Okay.
But it doesn't mean I hated it. I think if people out there, if you haven't seen it and are planning on it, like, just remember the camp that Godzilla movies have historically had in the past, and it's not out of left field for them to have it. So maybe shake your head a little less severely than you normally would reacting to something like that. But, you know, despite its problems and stuff like that, I still, you know, enjoyed myself. I'm glad I saw it, but it is my least favorite of the franchise so far.
I think 2014 is my least favorite, partially because there's so little Godzilla in it. It's so dark, as we know. And
that is a big detractor. It's just, for me, I think it's more, I felt more connected and cohesive storytelling, and there was some emotion there. Like, regardless of some of the actual performances of some of the actors, they went through the time to sort of set up the storyline in this verse in that first movie. And yes, I've said it 1,000 times, the visuals of that movie piss me off. But I still didn't have, I think I enjoyed, you know, story and plot and everything wise, I think I enjoy the first movie more.
I can understand that. And to be fair, focusing on the camp, this movie isn't like Raging Camp, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and there are funny parts, again, especially if you leave out the human stuff, if you leave out the banter and everything there, and you're just talking about the stuff you get with the monsters, there are some funny parts that are kind of, they make you laugh, but I understand where the label can be campy, and it follows in the tradition, so that's kind of mostly where Chad's going with it, but it's not blatantly, it's not as crazy obvious yet, or as the best, like Chad used some of the examples of Godzilla with the, you know, with the flying tail drop kick, or given like the okay signal and to Jet Jaguar and stuff like that. It's not like that. It's kind of like I would describe. It's like Kong just not, you know, most of it really does have to do with Kong. It's like, hey, he's being attacked by a bunch of gorillas and Zuko's biting him too. So he uses Zuko as a weapon. That's funny. And knocking out that asshole gorilla, getting in his face for being who was being a bully, and Kong just takes him out with one punch. That's funny. It's just a bunch of stuff like that. But I enjoyed it. I think it is cool to see on a big screen. I think it does. It is worth seeing, I think, on the big screen if you haven't seen it.
Yeah. So I will say, like, just as an example, something that because it just popped into my mind, there are things they just quite literally drop or don't explain. For instance, yes, you're talking about the telepathy of the tribe, but they're specifically referring to Gia and her ability to communicate with this tribe. It's very clear that her, and again, I'm bad at character names, but Gia's mom is not like telepathically communicating with the tribe. She's just, you know, getting the sense, she's nodding, yes, I have permission to go up to my daughter now, you know, so on and so forth. But later on in the film, the podcaster dude is clearly like understanding the intent of what they're doing in all of this. And it's like, how do you know all this? It's like there wasn't like some magic water that everybody had to drink to, you know, get on the telepathic network of this tribe or whatever. But how is he understanding what they're doing with the pyramids and like all? It's just, there were moments in this film that you're just going to be like, you know what, just swallow it and watch. So
yeah, I think there is an element of that. I think there's no doubt about that. But I think It is one of those things that if you think about it too much, then this is probably the wrong movie for you.
Yeah.
So one last thing before we go, and this will keep it relatively contained. The Silver Surfer. How much of a headbanger is that? Because it's like, and conceptually, it's never happened in the comic book. So it like happened like barely in the comic book. So there's no long story tradition of having a Shala Baal version of the Silver Surfer. But on some level, it's like, it's almost like you have to feel that it's like Feige and company at this point, they just can't help themselves. It's almost like the only lesson that they learned is, oh, I have to be more hands-on in these projects and everything will turn out fine if I am. Not any of the other criticisms. It just seems like it seems inherently stupid and at any basic level that you finally have the rights to use these characters, these classic Fantastic Four characters that you've been waiting for so long to get the rights back, then making us wait indefinitely to finally put to get the movie together, to cast it, to get it into production, and you're not going to give people the classic version, if this is true. Now, they haven't denied it, and you have to assume if it really wasn't true, they would have denied it because they know it's not going to be good publicity for them. It's like, why? It's like, because you know this is all people are going to talk about. It has nothing to do whether she can do a good job. It has nothing to do whether the movie is written and it makes perfect sense, or it's a, oh, this is an opening salvo, so eventually when you get the Norrin Rad version, you're going to appreciate. It doesn't matter. You know, this is all people are going to be thinking about and going, oh, here we go. It's like, I just don't get it. It just seems inherently stupid. I'm not thrilled with the cast anyway before this, you know, so I don't know. And I've been a big champion of this project, and that kind of just like pulled the rug out from underneath me going, well, maybe a lot of the other people are going to be right about this.
Yeah, I can't get too up in arms about it. I'm not a Fantastic Four guy. I have other ties in the Marvel universe that I prefer. I've tried to read Fantastic Four from lots of different eras, and I can't do it. I don't know what it is, but I just can't. I will say I am aware of their impact and significance in the Marvel universe. And I don't just mean like, you know, being a big popular team, a big popular name from the franchise that is Marvel. I know, you know, a lot of just contextually of what Reed means to that universe. So it's what Sue's, you know, relationships or, you know, their kids. If you get to that point, you know, Johnny and Ben and all this stuff. I know what those characters mean to the larger universe. I know what they mean to Spider-Man and stuff like that. If they ever end up going that route and maybe him and Johnny having a relationship or whatever, just being good buds. There's a lot about the Fantastic Four that I can appreciate and admire and want to see preserved, but I have no reading of the material attached to that. It's all side, you know, absorbed from the side of things. So, you know, I know that there was a female Silver Surfer, but I never read it, and I never read much of the regular Silver Surfer, so it doesn't really impact me too much. But, you know, I just trust that the other people who were fans of stuff and have the reading experience know, you know, they can have that fight if they want it. So
obviously we're going to have to see how it plays out, but but you know, the rumors were, it's not surprising this was coming because we heard rumors in the fall. This was the deal. People, I just kind of thought, well, maybe if it was true, it had been changed when we heard that they were doing some restructuring and about projects. But apparently not. So probably the rumor also heavily that the script is going to be Sue Storm centric and not Reed centric is probably also true because we were hearing those rumors from the fall too. So if one's true, when there's smoke, there's probably fire. So we'll see. I have not been turned off about it, but I think it's dumb. I think it's inherently, why wouldn't you use the class? I know the hints are that this is not going to be in our universe to start with, that the Fantastic Four are not coming from the 616 to start with, that this is a different universe. And that way, I guess it opens the door. But in a way, that's not going to make it any easier for the average fan to accept if they're going to have an issue with, because they know, the comic book readers know, and even people seeing the movies think of the Silver Surfer as Norrin Rad. So, yeah, but we'll see. I just thought it was a perfect, I mean, the only thought that, like I said, that crossed my mind was it's almost like they can't help themselves at this point. It's like, it's just, they just got to plow ahead until maybe everything absolutely hits rock bottom and nobody literally cares anymore. And it's like, okay.
No, there's one other thing I wanted to bring up just before we run out of time. Over on our YouTube channel, I had posted an unboxing of the Panini 2017 Panini Games Green Lantern Meta X cards. I have now found every other card in that set, so I have a full set, except for one card, which is called In Blackest Night. And I don't want to make a whole nother video for the Panini game stuff, so I'm just going to drop this information here. Thanks to somebody online who runs the Main Deck Games Twitter account. His name is Dan Green. Apparently, this card was scheduled to be printed with all of the others, but somehow in the printing, they missed this card. It was never actually printed with all of the other cards, despite not being a particularly rare card originally planned for the set, for the deck. And you had to go to Panini Games website to fill out a form to get copies of this card if you wanted it. Well, obviously this card set came out in 2017, so that form is null and void. So technically, one of the rarest cards in the set was never intended to be such because it was missed on a print run. Dan might be hooking me up with one of them because he got it. I think he said he might have an extra set, so we'll see. But I wanted to mention that because I thought that was a weird bit of Green Lantern trivia to not have out there somewhere in the ecosystem, that there is this TCG set out there with a random rare Green Lantern card in the midst of all these other Green Lantern cards.
Yeah, that I would say that. I did not know that. No.
Well, if people want to reach out to us, how do they do so?
Lanterncast@gmail.com. The website is lanterncast.com. You can, excuse me, I got a yawn. Oh. You can follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, #GLcast. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean. Whichever platforms you listen to us on, please leave us a positive review. Last but not least, if you'd like to leave us a text or a voicemail, 708-LANTERN, and let us know what you think.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.